So I thought I'd start with the astrophysics one. You might have seen this a couple of days ago. I think Sergei showed this picture of the galaxies in the first comprehensive galaxy survey, and he pointed out this clustering sort of thing that goes on here. And so what do they use to try and characterize that? Well, they do some kind of topological analysis, and that was the subject of this paper. In particular, they use the Euler characteristic to try and characterize this or quantify this kind of structure. So anyway, I thought I'd show you this. This is just a little bit of fun that I did to, I'm not an astrophysicist at all. It was really very hard for me to try and put this together. But I was just so curious to see what the data actually looked like. So this is supposed to be the Earth going around the Sun. It's not to scale, as you can see. And if we sort of back out a little bit here, that's supposed to be our galaxy. It's not a very correct sort of picture. The white blobs around are neighboring galaxies. In fact, there's one you can see right here, which is almost touching the rings of our own galaxy, which was discovered only recently. And another one over here was discovered recently as well, which is sort of hidden by the galaxy center. And gee, if you're a Star Trek fan, if you draw some axes through the galaxy center like this, then I think this is Alpha Quadrant, Beta Quadrant, Gamma Quadrant, Delta Quadrant, I think. And anyway, so this is our local cluster of galaxies. I'll sort of back off like this so that you can see. I've kind of drawn them to scale so that you can sort of appreciate the size of them. So they get a little bit faint after a while, so it actually looks better than my. If I readjust this and put the, I can find my little things here, make them all the same size. Actually, it turns out our own Milky Way is, in the local cluster, is the second largest galaxy in the local cluster. And so there's our local cluster. Now let me just switch off our galaxy, and let me put on the CFA galaxy survey. Whoops. Rotated away, I was actually sort of inside it. So there we are, and I'll make the axes a little bit larger so we won't lose track of where our own galaxy is, which is at the intersection of these things here. And then I'll just sort of back off so that you can see the rest of the galaxy survey. You still see us down there. And there's the sort of the 3D CFA galaxy survey. And we can have a little peek inside if I change this to change the transparency, then you can actually see inside. So what I've got inside there is the galaxy, smoothed galaxy density, and I didn't use the fancy Delaunay-based smoothing that we saw earlier in the week. This is just running over the data with the Gaussian filter, so consequently you do lose quite a bit of the structure that we saw in the earlier presentation. Anyway, there it is, threshold, and I put it on a Gaussian scale, so it's thresholded at a value of +1 on a Gaussian scale. And what's interesting here is this large feature. Oh, by the way, this is our local cluster right here, this little blob here. Then there's a bit of a void, and then there's this thing called the Great Wall, which stretches right across the survey from one end to the other. And if I increase the threshold a little bit, then it sort of splits up into little pieces, or if I decrease the threshold, then it starts to sort of less like that. Now, what the astrophysicists use to characterize this and compare our own galaxy, say, with some kind of model for the creation of large-scale structure is the Euler characteristic. And then I've got at the top here, which is just sort of, you know, number of blobs minus number of tunnels plus number of interior hollows. And down the bottom here, this is the Euler characteristic of that set. It's +16. So presumably, if there are no tunnels and no hollows, there should be 16 blobs there. If I crank up the threshold a little bit, you can probably, you can see how it's increasing to 18 now. And if I go a little bit higher, it starts to thin out. And now it's sort of getting smaller and smaller. Well, it's 2 now. So you can see the two bits there, 1, 2. So that's 2 blobs. There's no tunnels, no hollows. And so the one characteristic.
What is expected?
Now, where that's going to come to, the whole purpose of the talk is the expected.
Oh, okay.
Because that's the part that interests me. So it's just sort of like motivation, if you like, for the expected one. So the expected Euler characteristic is what you would get if it was just Poisson random noise smoothed with a a Gaussian kernel. I know this is a completely silly model, but I'm just a statistician and I was kind of curious to see how it happened. So the formula there for the expected is this, is the whole idea that the theoretical side of both this talk and like Jonathan Taylor's talk is how we work out this expected weather characteristic thing down here. So what you see is an observed of 2, an expected of 7. We would, if you like, expect to see about 7 blobs, if you like, at that threshold. And in fact, we only see 2. So there's some sort of evidence there, perhaps things are coalescing and forming, you know, large clusters. But not so many isolated voids. In fact, if I could, I did some simulation and I put in some random galaxies, just Poisson white noise, and there, that's what you get for just random galaxies, an observed of 10 and expected of 7. And now when you sort of crank down the threshold, you observe 61, you expect 48, and so on. So this is what random stuff looks like. For comparison, this is what the real stuff looks like. So it's quite a bit more clustered than just pure noise. Everyone knows that, it's just that. Also, but I should illustrate the hollows as well. If you do decrease the threshold down to around about 0, it becomes negative because the tunnels start to take over, as you can see here.
So how again did you produce the random?
Oh, I just simulated it, just threw down some random points.
Yeah, but then you made them to join.
Oh, then I smoothed them with a Gaussian.
Invented the threshold.
And then threshold, yeah, just in the same way as the galaxies themselves. So it's a really silly model, that's just for illustrative purposes. But it's kind of interesting, well, I just want to get down to a negative threshold. It actually goes positive again at the negative threshold. Why is that? It's because the voids, there are voids inside there which contribute +1. And this is the little bit that I worked on at 2 o'clock this morning, is to try and peel away some of that so that you can actually see the voids inside. So there you can see the... Well, there's a void right there. So that would contribute +1 to the weather characteristic because it's a void. And that would contribute +1 as well. So somehow or other, you end up with +5 for the weather characteristic of this thing. So anyway, there it is. And you know, just out of curiosity, I've been collecting slow digital sky survey data. And why don't we have a look at that? Now here I have to disable this guy. And it takes a little while to read in, but you saw the Slow Digital Sky Survey. People have been talking about it all through the week. It's the latest galaxy survey. It goes out much further than the CFA survey, far more comprehensive. And it's just full of all kinds of fascinating structure. So if this thing works, then you'll see it. There you go. So that's, I guess I set the threshold way too. Set the threshold. It's doing an awful lot of geometry, number crunching here. Cross my fingers and hope it doesn't crash. I just put too many triangles in. Voids in the survey, there it is, it stretches out quite a long way. And if this thing would only work, look at the, set a sort of high threshold just to kind of persuade it to work. Now what? Oh, I know. I know exactly what it does, because I haven't enabled this. Hey. You know, driving this stunned Iris Explorer. Paul, are you still a fan of Iris Explorer?
Yeah, it's even free now, isn't it? Oh, no, they charge for it.
Well, there's a Mac version of it now, which is... may persuade me to get a Macintosh. Okay, there's the Slow Digital Sky Survey in all its glory. And, you know, the CFA survey, if you want to see that for comparison, so let's put that on as well. There's the CFA survey, sort of nestling down at the bottom of that. And let's be a bit more ambitious and crank the threshold down and cross our fingers that the graphics can't really crash. And then see if we can get it to... You know, I've been looking for this, what do they call it, the Sloan Great Wall, and I just don't know where it is. I mean, maybe you guys in the physics people can sort of show. But apparently there's a structure in here which is just as large as the Great Wall that we see in the CFA survey, and I just don't quite know what it means. Because it's hard to tell, because I've only done this rather crude Gaussian smoothing rather than the much better smoothing which preserves the filaments in the structure, which you saw earlier. Okay, so that's... Oh, by the way, you can work out the Euler characteristic as well there. It is 762, worked out on the fly. The expected is 1,400. Again, this is way lower than this, because there's evidence of clustering in this much larger galaxy.
What kind of variance?
I can show you. That's a good question. We don't know theoretically what the variance is. And in fact, in the astrophysics journals, they always calculate a variance by bootstrap recycling of the galaxy, or do it in error bars for this thing. But there's no, it's a challenging theoretical problem is to get an expression for the variance of this thing. Okay, so everyone happy with that? Okay, so let's switch this thing off. And I get so nervous doing this thing. It's nerve wracking, but it's these things. Okay, so back to the PowerPoint. Okay, so there we go. So we've done that. By the way, here's a plot of the Euler characteristic for the CFA survey, plotted against the threshold on the Gaussian scale. You see these things in many publications in the astrophysics journal. And the yellow one is the true CFA, which is a lot less than what you would get from a random points, which is the purpley one, and the smooth one in between there is the theoretical expectation over resamplings of the data. You notice it's not symmetric. In the astrophysics journal, you'll see a symmetric curve like this, and that's because I am actually counting the boundaries of the search region, of the survey region, as well as the inside, so it's taken into account. In fact, when the threshold gets really, really low, the Euler characteristic is plus one, which is correct because it's a whole piece.
And also, in the strategic, this all the opposite side because it.
Yes, you could actually flip the sign and do it for the voids instead of the other ones. Anyway, it's just more evidence that the thing's not random. Okay, so off we go. Now, the brain imaging part. Now, what we're going to do then is to use this Euler characteristic method, not for looking at the topology of brain activation, but just for detecting the presence of brain activation. So an MRI experiment, or an anatomical one, which I'll show you later on. So the idea is that you construct some sort of test statistic image for detecting activation, and the activated regions are where it's bigger than some threshold. And the you then have to choose some threshold to control the false positive rate, so that you don't end up submitting a paper to the Journal of Neuroscience, which is full of false activations, which are not really there. So, in effect, then, you need to work out the probability that the maximum of this test statistic would ever cross the threshold, set back to, say, 0.05, and work backwards to find the threshold. Bonferroni is an obvious choice there for trying to at least get a bound on that. But it turns out that expected Euler characteristic gets an approximation to this, which is extraordinarily accurate. I mean, Jonathan might tell you tomorrow exactly how accurate that can be. So here's the idea behind it. First of all, I'll show you an interesting kind of projection region for a test statistic that Jonathan and I are working on called a Chi-bar statistic, which is the maximum of linear combination of two Gaussians over an angle between 0 and pi by 2. This kind of test statistic is particularly useful at detecting activation, say, in Z1 and Z2, where you expect the activation to be positive in both of them. And so here's a couple of examples of random fields, to simulate the random fields of Z1 and Z2. And here's the Chi-bar statistic on a color scale here, colored by the threshold. As you can see, it takes zero values in these regions, because in those regions, then maybe Z1 and Z2 are both negative, and so it takes the value 0. Here's what the rejection region looks like. It's sort of an odd kind of thing. You follow the contours, if you like, of this rejection region as a function of Z1 and Z2. So in other words, the sort of bluey stuff here would be everything outside of that bluey stuff would be the rejection region at that particular level, and that would translate into the bluey stuff and above, if you like, in this image down here. So there's a direct tie-in between the colors in this and the colors in that. And what I want to do is to try and draw that analogy out as I go through the presentation, because it turns out that the way in which we get this p-value approximation, this expected Euler characteristic, turns out to be kind of symmetric in these two images. That is, what you do there is similar to what you do there. Oh, I should say I've drawn a search region here, like a little sort of cartoon brain. We would, of course, normally be only interested in what happens inside this and the stuff outside.
So in the two top pictures, what is it that's n of 0, 1?
The individual values at each of these points is standard normal.
Oh, so it's a field.
It's a random field, right. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, so it's a random field. And I've chosen some isotropic smoothness. I took white noise and I smoothed it from the Gaussian kernel to make those two pictures in that way. So that's what they are. But the idea is that this is plotted on this axis, that one is plotted on that axis, and if you had a point here and here in this picture, then you'd look to see where that point was here. That would give you a value, a color, if you like, which would tell you what the value would be at the corresponding point in that image. Get the idea? In fact, it's going to work for any kind of rejection region. It doesn't have to be when some test statistic crosses a threshold. These rejection regions could, in fact, be arbitrary sets.
So in the lower left, you're simply varying t.
Yeah, in fact, I'm varying t in both of these points.
Level sets of
right, so that the little red stuff there corresponds to this bit here, where you've got a chi bar of around about +4. So that's the thing that works. That seem okay? All right, so then off we go. Again, here's that same sort of Euler characteristic plot so that you can see how the Euler characteristic is going to come in. Here's that the excursion sets now obtained by thresholding what you just saw, that chi bar statistic, at thresholds ranging from 0 up to 4. You get the idea? I just sort of color-coded them so that they match the colors on the previous And here's the Euler characteristic. 1 for this set, 7, 6, 5, 2 for that, because you've got two bits there, 5 here, because you've got 5 little bits there. I guess you must have some hollow right here, which would give you a minus 1 for this guy here, which would get a plus 1 there, plus 1 there, and a minus 1 for that guy. And 0 for this, because by this time the excursion set is empty. And here's a plot of that Euler characteristic. This function is the sort of step function that you see right here. And then on top of that is its expectation under random resamplings, if you like, of this random regeneration, if you like, of this underlying function of z1 and z2. And what we really want to do is get a formula for this thing. Now, why this is useful as a p-value approximation is buried in this picture. If you get to very, very high thresholds, say around about 3 or 3.5, I think you can appreciate the fact that the excursion set, the yellow blob here, is either going to be have something in it or it's going to be empty. But at such high thresholds, you can imagine there won't be any tunnels or hollows, and so the Euler characteristic will either be 1 or it will be 0. And so it follows from that the expectation of the Euler characteristic should be a very good approximation to the p-value for whether the maxima crosses the threshold t. Get the idea? So here's the maximum is 3.1 or something. If you're lower than the maximum, so you're here at 3, you'll get that with the Euler characteristic at 1. If you're above the max, you get that with the Euler characteristic at 0. It therefore follows that the chance that the max is above some fixed threshold is the expectation of the Euler characteristic, roughly. Provided that you don't get multiple pieces and that you don't get holes and handles. And that heuristic turns out to be extraordinarily accurate. I think Jonathan will tell you exactly what the error is in between these two things here. So then, if you've got this, you can approximate that. You can then set this to 0.05, work it backwards, find the threshold that would correspond to 0.05 here, and it turns out this little data set to be 3.75. So that would give you the appropriate threshold, the thing we're really after, for screening out the false positives in a test statistic image of these chi bar things. Does that seem okay? So that's the sort of the heuristic, if you like, behind it. It's now been more than a heuristic, it's a, got some solid theory behind it. Okay, now how do we get this guy? So I haven't told you how to get this expected order characteristic. And here, this red box is the sort of main result. The expectation of the Euler characteristic is a sum of things that depend on the search region times things that depend on the rejection region through the threshold. And it splits into that in that fashion. So, you know, linear combination of these, where D is, in this case, 2, is the number of dimensions that you're working in. And so there's this lovely kind of symmetry where you get something that depends on S, something that depends on the rejection. The S, this is the excursion set, which is in a sense the rejection region of the test statistic. So I won't go into the details of how that's proved, but I'll just tell you what these two somethings are down here, this guy and this guy. So here we go to the next slide. There it is again at the top, there's the formula, just to remind you. I worked all night last night to try and get stupid old PowerPoints to sort of, you know, put the superscript there in the right place. I have to figure out how to do it. And I was too lazy to try and do it in LaTeX. So you have to put up with it. So anyway, here's the picture. So the way in which you work out these two coefficients, this one is called Lipschitz-Killing curvature. This one is called the UC density. The way in which you do it is quite symmetric. Let's start with the point up here. Let's start with the Lipschitz-Killing curvature of the search region S. The idea is that you put a tube around about the search region, that is to say, a contour, if you like, of constant radius R away from the search region. You work out its area, and here I've plotted the area as a function of the radius. So radius going from 0 up to 2. This has to be done, by the way, in units of four width half max over root 4 log 2 of the smoothing curve. Well, I can't explain why this funny factor comes in here. But it's done in sort of units of the smoothness, if you like, of the random field. So it's kind of unitless in some sense. So you get this little function. You have a plot of the area of the tube as a function of the radius. And then you expand it as a power series in the radius. And the coefficients that come off this power series are the Lipschitz-Killing curvatures. Here's the constant term, it turns out to be L2 of S. Here's the linear term, which is twice L1 of S times the radius. And here's the quadratic term, which is pi L1 of S times R squared. So it's just simply a power series expansion of this function as a function of R. Coefficients give you the Lipschitz-Killing curvatures. This was being known since the 1930s, known as the Steiner-Weyl-Fond-Chews formula. Remarkable result that Jonathan Taylor's found just in the last few years is that there's a similar kind of expansion for the EC densities. We start with the rejection region here. We put it, that's the rejection region of the black stuff, right? That's big values of Z1 and Z2, where you reject the test statistic. You come in by a tube of radius R, just like we did over there. Instead of working out the volume of the tube, the area of the tube, you work out its probability content. This is the idea. And again, you expand the thing as a power series in the radius. And lo and behold, it turns out the coefficients that you pick off this are these EC densities that we need for this formula at the top. So this is a most remarkable result. The proof of this is really hard. Jonathan's got a new proof, which he's just submitted with Robert Adler to the Annals of Mathematics. But I still find it really, there's no, it begs a sort of a lovely, simple proof, but it seems that the proof is not so simple. Hey, Jonathan, aren't you going to have a go at trying to prove this? Anyway, he told me last night, anyway, he's going to have a crack at the proof of this thing. Anyway, it's the same story. The power series is infinite here, but it does terminate in a number of dimensions there. And then, again, if you pick off the constant linear and quadratic terms at the origin here, the radius is zero, you will get these other characteristic densities. So let's see how this works in practice. We'll start actually with the EC densities one. Let's take that rejection region again. There's Jonathan's Gaussian kinematic formula, as we as he calls it. And all you have to do is expand this guy as a power series in the radius. It turns out in this particular type of rejection region, when you step in by a radius R, the neat thing is that you end up with another rejection region of the same shape as the previous one, but with a lower threshold. And so it's actually rather easy to work out the probability content of this tube. It's just a little integral like that. So once you've got this guy, you just expand it as a power series, and you pull off the coefficients of these densities. So that's the way it goes, and this will carry on forever. So that's how you can do the Taylor's kinematic formula for the. Go back to the Lipschitz-Kerning's curvature. That's these measures, geometric measures of a set. Here you can do this also for some simple things. Here's a triangle, for instance. Here's a tube of radius r about the triangle, and the Steiner-Weyl bonded tube formula says that this is the formula for the bonding of the tube, and its coefficients pick off these Lipschitz-Kerning curvatures. So again, expand it like that, and if you look at this thing and just think, yeah, you can just a little bit of geometry, you can actually figure out what the area of this tube is. It's this plus this plus this. You can figure it out for yourself. And so by equating coefficients, you end up with these guys down here for the Lipschitz-Kerning's curvatures of a triangle. They're one half the perimeter length and the area of the triangle. So now we've got the two ingredients. We've got the EC densities, or at least we've got the Lipschitz-Kerning's curvatures for a triangle. So we put them together, we can work out the expected order characteristic of the excursion set, and then we can work out p-back approximation. But of course, life is not so simple, because in real life, you've got a search region, which is not a triangle, but something like a brain. So the way to try and figure out the Lipschitz-Kerning curvatures for this is as follows. You first of all have to devise a method for filling the brain with triangles, or tetrahedras in three dimensions. And here I've done it by this kind of funny interpolation method, where I sort of move mesh points to the boundary. It doesn't really matter how you do this. You don't have to sort of make all the triangles equal area or anything like that. And so here's the brain full of little triangles. Then you sort of pull them all apart and write the whole thing as a union of little triangles, little lines, and little points, like that. So you can see how you might do this in higher dimensions. Then you work out the Lipschitz-Kerning's curvatures for each of these components, points, edges, and triangles. And there's the formula. You can work, and in fact, that's the one that we just did for the triangle. We just figured this one out just a few minutes ago. And then you put these together in a sort of union intersection formula to get the Lipschitz-Kerning's curvatures for the union of all of these guys. And so that gives you this thing down here. So now we've got a mechanism for working out the Lipschitz-Kerning curvature of an arbitrary kind of set. Things get more tricky when you've got non-isotropic data, and this is where the geostatistics again come in. Here's a non-isotropic. You can see it's not isotropic because it's got a twisty kind of excursion set there, so it's clearly not isotropic. The other one had sort of round excursion sets. And the first idea that you might have is that, well, let's work out the derivative of the standard deviation of the derivative of this mesh of triangles along each of the edge lengths of the triangles. And here I've done that and color-coded it so you can see what happens. If it was isotropic, this would be a uniform color. And the fact that you've got red bits here means that it's actually too, let me think now, it's too steep, it's too rough in these regions here, and it's too smooth in these regions over here. Why don't I have that? Not sure if I have, actually. Anyway, the idea that you might have is, why can't we sort of warp this to isotropy? Why can't we rearrange the edge lengths of these triangles so that the whole thing then becomes isotropic and has equal smoothness, if you like, along each of the edges. And you could do that by multiplying the edge lengths by this standard deviation of the derivative. It turns out you can do it locally, but you need extra dimensions to pop this thing into. And I think I have Nash embedding theorem in the abstract. Turns out that the number of extra dimensions you need is not infinite, it's finite. And you could do this in principle in five dimensions. In fact, this is the basis of this geostatistics paper, which is where the idea originally comes from Samson and Godot, 1992, where they had a problem of trying to model the spatial correlation function of, I think, what was it, solar energy temperature measures or something at these recording stations in Vancouver, British Columbia. And what they did was to rearrange the locations of these points in such a way, as you can see they've done it down here, that the correlation between these measurements was roughly proportional to the distance between the points. And so you ended up with something like that. In fact, this one, which is Grouse Lake, is it? No, it's in the mountains here, and it's being pushed far away because it's not very correlated, as it turns out, with all these other ones down here. So that's the idea. There's quite an industry in statistics world is to try and capture spatial, non-isotropic spatial correlation by this kind of method. There's someone I was speaking to yesterday. Is he here, the guy from Berkeley? Anyway, he has just published a paper on this in the Annals of Statistics, so he's got some kind of interest. So the lovely thing about this application is you don't actually have to do it. So if you think about it, you don't have to deform this to isotropy. You can just take all those little bit of triangles, just rearrange the sizes of the triangles so their edge length is proportional to the standard deviation of the derivative, and then work these things out in the same way as before. So the warping to isotropy idea is not necessary. You can do it without that. And that's how the software works. It just rearranges the edge lengths of the little components there, forgets about trying to put them together into a continuous object, and then just works out Lipschitz curvatures separately, and then adds them up minus one. If you have to do this on real data, what you invariably end up with is usually residuals, that is, replicates, if you like, of the random field, lots of them, say 100 in the typically in an fMRI experiment, or 400 in one of, if you've got 400 subjects, you end up with about 400 residuals. And you can estimate these correlations empirically for the edge lengths of these triangles. What it turns out to be is just that you simply replace the coordinates of these points of the triangles by the normalized residuals in n dimensions. N is the number of little images you've got. And then you follow through this thing as before. So it's a beautifully simple little calculation. Mind you, doing it in MATLAB is not so easy. The hard part is chopping up cubes into tetrahedra. That's really, keeping track of them is a real mess. Anyway, it turns out these guys are unbiased in some conditions. So that's how you do these things. So now we've got all the ingredients together. We've got the Lipschitz, Koenig's curvatures, we have to figure those out. We've got the Euler characteristic densities. So now I would like to finish, if I have time, with 5 minutes. That will be just enough time. Well, it's a shape analysis week, so here's the best I can do for a shape analysis example. It's not really shape analysis, but maybe it's close enough. This is a data set that we've got on multiple sclerosis lesions, and on 425 subjects. And we have measured the lesion density and the cortical thickness all around the outer cortex. This is my surrogate shape analysis here. And the hypothesis is that if you have an MS lesion, it's going to cut neuronal signals to the cortex, and thus giving a negative correlation with. So we want to try and detect that in the data by looking at all pairs of points in 3D and on a 2D surface where the correlation is sufficiently, and in a negative sense. So let me show you an example of this. That guy. Cross my fingers, I hope this works. Arno, we'll call it Arno because this is Arno's data, so that's the name of the file. This doesn't want to take quite so long to come up with the galaxy. Okay, so there's one subject. Now, this is just happens to be the first subject in our database. There is a point of the surface extracted by our old-fashioned technology, which does the two hemispheres together rather than separately. And I've color-coded it by the cortical thickness. So now, over on this side, I am going to peel away a little bit of the brain so we can have a peep inside. And I think, just in here, right. You will see some MS lesions. So there's a lesion right there. It's lesion density, so it's been smooth. There's another one there. Let me crank down the threshold a little bit so that we can. Because I want to show you. There's a, yeah, this is what I want to show you. Look at that. There's a lesion density. There's a lesion right there in the cortical. In the visual area, and if you look at the thickness, it's thinner on this side than on that side. Get the idea? So the hypothesis is that the presence of that lesion is causing the cortex over here to get thinner than over there. So that's the hypothesis. I was just lucky, it happened to be the first subject in the data set. So we want to try and detect that by measuring lesion density at 425 subjects right here. Same thing over here, cortical thickness, and then looking for negative correlation between the two. Now, if you think about it for a moment, this creates a random field of correlation. So I'll quickly throw
up. Keith, are you going to try to bring the other side? Are you going to do something that sort of is the thickness module on the other side? You have a reference that's very powerful, right? I mean, that's what you're doing.
Well, we're going to search globally for everything. What I'm going to show you is an excursion set where you just look for every pair of correlations which is bigger than the threshold.
Okay, so you're not just going. So
I'm not. I haven't got any particular.
You're not trying to use.
You see, Paul wants to keep you the time, so I've got it.
He's in passing.
Here's the theory quickly, and I couldn't redo this at 2 o'clock this morning, but it's the same formula. This is the p-value that the maximum correlation bigger than the threshold is approximated, this time by a double sum. These are supposed to be Lipschitz-Killings curvatures, but they're not, they're called results, it doesn't matter, they're kind of the same thing. This is supposed to be the rho, the order characteristic density, and there is the formula for that guy, worked out by brute force by myself and a graduate student a few years back. So you set this thing to 0.05, solve it backwards for the critical correlation, it's 0.325, corresponding to a t statistic of about 7. Okay, so what I'm going to do then is show you all the correlations which are bigger than some threshold, in a negative sense. So let's see if I can do this in the software. I'll put the brain back together again so that you can see it. I'll warp it to the average cortical surface because it kind of looks a lot better on the average surface. So there's the average. There's the average surface. It's just the average point-wise of all the mesh points. And it does seem to preserve a lot of the anatomy. Jason is a huge fan of this stuff. Right, Jason? There he is. Okay, so now I'm going to put the correlations inside this. And I'll switch this to on, and I have to change the thresholding, so now we peep inside, and we're going to look. It turns out, above 0.325, there are 25,761 correlations, and so but not here. A huge number. So I'm only going to show you, say, the top 200. And there they are, like that. So that's the top 200. So this is an excursion set. It's the set of all pairs of points where the correlation exceeds a certain critical value. I've culled a lot of them. I'm just showing the local maxima. But it's kind of interesting. Let me make the lesions a little bit transparent so you can peep inside. Let's have a look at one of these guys, say here. And I'll show you what the interpretation is. So what the interpretation is that if you've got lesions in this region, this little white arrow is right at the peak. It's actually the biggest, it's the maximum of this cross-correlation random field. If you've got lesions here, you get cortical thinning right there, which tends to validate this hypothesis that neighboring cortex should be affected by lesions in that particular place. So anyway, the data is a terrible thing to analyze. Arno has been staring at this for months to try and make some sense of it. He kind of gave up in the end. There are just a huge number of correlations. Some of them, as you know, you said, Mike, they go from one hemisphere to the other. You can see that lesions here seem to be causing thinning in the other hemisphere, which is really strange. I'm not quite sure why that should happen. It does seem to have a certain sort of symmetry to it, so maybe it's something to do with that. And I can show you more, and then I'll just stop, because there are a lot of these guys. I'll show you, if my graphics card will survive it, here's the top 500. Trying to sort of find a good interpretation for these is really hard. Try clustering them. Actually, a good old principal components, it turns out, works really well in this data. Well, so that singular value decomposition.
Principal components on what?
On the, just on the matrix of, this cross-correlation matrix.
Cross-correlation.
Yeah. An SVD, actually. Cross-correlation. And I can show you that.
But if you showed us that, IPAM would take your math card away.
So maybe I had some comment about level sets. I bumped into someone this morning and couldn't resist saying something about level sets if anyone was at all interested. Where's my card? I've been thinking, you know, because I've been attending these presentations on level sets and ways we could use this technology for looking at level sets with error. And it's getting an error bar, if you like, to these segmentations that you're producing by level set method, by assuming perhaps that the level function has additive error to it of a smooth sort. And a little ad for my PhD student, Farzan Rohani, has been doing exactly that. He had a poster on it at the HBM meeting last year in France, where we were trying to give a confidence region for an activated region of the brain. It didn't really work terribly well. We're still kind of working on this. It doesn't have the right confidence coverage, but it applies. So I just threw that in the last minute, so I think I better stop.